Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. November 20th marked the 50th anniversary of the Indigenous occupation of Alcatraz. It was a powerful moment and continues to be for Indigenous people. We recently spoke with Lenaida Warjack about the occupation. She was one of the leaders of the 19-month-long political protest. Today, we will continue that conversation with a look at another organizer, Richard Oakes. Richard Oakes was a young Akwesasne Mohawk iron worker and a San Francisco State University student. He was a high-profile member of the original protesters. Today's guest, Kent Blancett, first learned about Richard Oakes and the occupation of Alcatraz when he was an undergrad student at the University of Missouri. He wanted to know more about Oakes' life before and after Alcatraz, but he couldn't find much. He couldn't find any books. So he decided to write one, and his effort took 18 years. Kent Blancett is Cherokee, Creek, Choctaw, Shawnee, and Potawatomi. He's Associate Professor of History and Native American Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And his new book is called A Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz, and the Red Power Movement. And Professor Blancett joins us in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. What an amazing effort this is. 18 years. I know you took a little bit of time off for school, but 18 years on this book. What was it about Richard Oakes that grabbed you?
Yeah. So when I was at the University of Missouri, I was also one out of 25 Native students out of a total population of about 25,000 students at the university. And my first semester there, I think the current president of our Native student organization was on the way out and just said, which there was only about two or three members at the time, he was like, "Well, you want to be president?" And I said, "I guess I have no choice." And so I started looking into activism at that point, because what I discovered in my first semester at Mizzou is that the physical anthropology department held about 3,000 remains of our ancestors that they use for scientific study and experimentation. And so shortly thereafter, there was this new legislation that was coming out of self-determination called NAGPRA. And out of that, I led a four-year struggle at the University of Missouri to finally get the university to repatriate our ancestors back so that their human and civil rights would be protected finally, and also that their journeys would continue on into the spirit world. And so out of this, I got involved with the American Indian Movement. I got involved in protests on campus in regards to repatriation, and I started reading voraciously. I would disappear into the books, so to speak. And when I grew up, I grew up in a very small town in the Ozarks, of about a town of about 1,000 people. And I remember in my high school, we had two books. One was Vine Deloria's Custer Died for Your Sins, and then we had Thurman Wilkinson's Cherokee Tragedy. And I read those two books, and I thought they were the only two books that existed. Now, mind you, internet hadn't come out yet, so it's not like I could get on a cell phone at that point, dating myself, and go to Amazon and find a bunch of books. So when I went to the college, which I was very lucky to be able to go on to college, I was a first-generation student. I went to the E-Stacks, which when I discovered them, I discovered shelves and shelves of at least books on Native history. And the books that were pulling off the shelf all had to do with Red Power, all had to do with trying to figure out what is modern Native activism, what does it mean in the sense of the tactics, the approach, and learning and educating myself to become an activist at that point. And that's when I discovered Richard, because most of what had been written is was kind of inconsistent about his life and how he got to San Francisco. Most would mention he was charismatic. They would mention he was brawny and husky, physical characterizations. And there was a lot more that was kind of missing about his early years. And some didn't even mention that he had been murdered or assassinated in 1972. Some would just say that he was killed, but it was just very mysterious. And so his life after Alcatraz, I was always kind of left with this big question, like, who is this guy? And, you know, he didn't look, you know, standard, you know, in the sense of he basically looked like your everyday neighbor, but he had this kind of ability to kind of seize the cameras and to speak on the fly and speak from the heart, as we'd say. He could literally put his finger on the pulse of what was going on at the in that period and relate it for an entire community. And so for me, I began to say, well, okay, well, what happened here? And it stayed with me. And then when I did my master's at the University of New Mexico, I had a course on biography. And my professor in this graduate course, which I was doing my graduate degree in history at the time, was Frank Saz. And Frank taught this biography class. And he went around the room and he said, "Hey, is there somebody that has just stayed with you forever that you've wanted to know more about?" He said, "If you're picking a person to write about for this biography seminar, that's a person you should choose." And instantaneous for me, it was Richard Oakes. And out of that, it started this journey in which I was going through the archives at UNM. I was going through underground newspapers like Akwesasne Notes, and I was pulling anything I could find about him. And some of my professors weren't really keen on this. I mean, it's really unusual to write a dissertation or have your first book be a biography because they're so involved and invested with writing them, for one. But they also questioned this idea of he only lived to be 30. What possibly could you write a whole book on somebody who only lived to be 30 years old? And to me, that was a challenge. I was like, I take you on that challenge. I'm going to do this.
Well, that's an interesting comment, because Martin Luther King was assassinated at a very young age, and I can't even imagine how many books have been written about him.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the mystique of Richard, is that his life was just confined to Alcatraz. And I think people were like, well, he only lived to be 30, and you know, his life was confined to just Alcatraz. And I'm like, no, it was bigger than that. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what started me on that journey. And so then I came out to San Francisco around 99, 2000, and I had to write a grant through my university at New Mexico to be able to raise enough money to come out. And that was the first chance I got to go to the island, which was magical for me. Became instantly obsessed with trying to track down as much as I could in the archives that had been written. So I went to San Francisco Public Library, San Francisco State, went through their records and documents. And then it was a chance meeting. There was a Red Power Conference shortly after that that occurred at the University of Kansas that was hosted by historian Don Fixico. And it was at that conference I was presenting a paper on Richard, the same paper I wrote for that biography seminar. And I remember reading the paper, and at the end of the paper, this individual, which was kind of uncustomary because normally you read your papers at these conferences and then, you know, you're done. The next person reads theirs. You wait for the final person to read theirs, and then there's a comment. Well, this individual gets up out of the audience, walks up to the front of the table as the other person's reading their paper that had started, and places a card on the table and says, I want your name and I want your number now. And I was like, oh my gosh, did I do something wrong? And I was like, okay, I better do this. And the other established professor who was giving comments on the papers was giving me a stern eye. I wrote it down. Afterwards, he came up and talked to me, and it was Robert Free. And Robert Free had worked with Richard Oakes. He'd been one of the veterans of the occupation. He'd helped in the writing of the newsletter for Indians of All Tribes. He'd set up the lodge or the teepee on the island. And he said, you know what? We've been waiting for this story, and you got it right. And I want to keep working with you, and we want to see this turned into a book. And so that gave me the inspiration. That gave me the connection with the vets. And so I began doing interviews with not only Robert. My first interview was with Dean Chavers, who was living in Albuquerque. And Dean had ran the mainland offices for the Indians of All Tribes, and he was the coordinator also of a lot of the press and press releases. In fact, he was on the boatload with the original 14 that night, but Richard made him stay on the boat because he said, you know what, you're in J school at UC Berkeley, and none of us know how to write a press release. You do. Mm. You need to go back, and you need to write a press release in order for us to be able to get the media involved in this. And sure enough, that's what helped save them that night from arrest, because the media showed up on that island alongside the Coast Guard, and that's how they were able to plea bargain out not getting arrested, and they were able to extend the movement to the new D-Day, which was November 20th. Mm. But Dean had flown 150 missions in Vietnam. He drove taxi cabs in and around San Francisco while he was going to Berkeley, and he basically was enthralled that there would be a book, and elated that there would be a book on Richard Oakes. And that's usually what I would run into. And of course, you know, there was a lot of mystery around Richard, and a lot of people were cautious about his story. And part of that was like being able to talk about, you know, the direction I was going with it, how I got into the writing the book itself, and those all seem to kind of get through the hurdles, so to speak, or the gauntlet of questions before people would begin to start to say, okay, yeah, we can trust you to tell the story. And that trust had to be something that was earned in the Indian community. And that was really important for me to also protect the family, because I was aware of the story. So it took years to kind of reach out to the family, too. But it was going through the vets and earning that respect along the way. So good things come in time.
It must have been amazing for you to start this project at such a young age, and then to stick with it for so long as you're getting older and becoming a man and learning about the world, to just immerse yourself in so much information, and then to meet, as you said, these incredible veterans.
Mm. Yeah, for me, it was meeting my heroes. So while other people were kind of, listening to Nirvana or Pearl Jam, I was reading about Richard Oakes.
You could do both, right?
Yeah, I was doing both. But, for me, it was, in the 90s, it was, as I say, this was an element of recovering what is our indigenous rights movement. Mm. And as a young indigenous man, it was hard for me to see where other movements were being covered in history and especially in the media. And as a young Native man, I wrote the book that I always wanted to read when I was that age. So it became kind of instrumental. It was almost like I was writing to my 18-year-old self when I was writing the book, because it was the book I'd always wanted to read. It was the book I needed to read at the time.
You point out that when you picked up books about the Black Panthers or the Brown Berets, for example, there was nothing in those books about indigenous issues.
That's correct. Yeah, no, it was really interesting to me to see that we're so celebratory of the 1960s, but a lot of the 60s scholars and people that write about the 60s write about these movements in vacuums. And what we began to see on the ground is that San Francisco, being one of the most cosmopolitan places on the planet at the time, the city, transported by love in the late 1960s, is also a city where there's a lot of cross-pollination between these organizations. And they owe a lot of their ideologies and philosophies to one another. It's, as I say, to me, that was important to showcase this idea of political coalitioning. And I think that's the root of a really strong grassroots political structure throughout America, is to see these kind of coalitions that form within the cities. And the story of Alcatraz became even more interesting when we began to kind of see where the Black Panther Party would work security for the island. And I found a photo that was in a rare journal called the National American Review. And this photo was of Richard Oakes and John Trudell meeting with Black Panther Party members and Mission Rebels coming out of the Mission District of San Francisco. And they volunteered to work security for the island, mainly because around the docks you had tons of spectators and they were kind of clogging up the docks. And the idea here was that you needed to have a little bit of crowd control to be able to get Native peoples to and from the island. And so you didn't want to have, at least members of Indians of all tribes necessarily managing crowd control when they couldn't also be a part of the movement on the island. And so this was a really great gesture. But then you had the Black Panther Party that was becoming inspired by ideas of indigeneity along the way. And some of this was spinning out of the Third World Liberation Front that was consuming college campuses from Berkeley to San Francisco State. But it was also transforming the people that were a part of those movements, where people were changing their names to Geronimo Pratt and literally honoring, early indigenous leaders and resistance movements, and channeling that history and being inspired by that history. And that became the early groundwork for what is indigenous studies to this day. Mm-hmm. Or the Brown Berets that were also coalitioning with at least Indians of all tribes. And they began to, formulate a new vision of Atzilan, but creating more indigenous movements through that association with linking up who they are as indigenous peoples within that movement and seeing this as more of a coalition and being proud of that indigeneity from a Latinx and Chicano Iconics standpoint in that period. And for me, that was really instrumental to pinpoint those issues and to showcase. I was watching a documentary on that was done, I think, by NPR on called Chicano. And I was trying to look for any kind of hint, right? You know, it was like looking through the index of these books to see if there's any kind of mention of Native peoples. And sure enough, I was watching a segment they had done on the moratorium marches in East L.A. And in the midst of this parade that was going down the streets in East L.A. For this moratorium march, which was a protest against the Vietnam War that the Brown Berets had organized and sponsored, in that sea of people, there was a sign that just popped out. And that sign said, Indians of all tribes. And I paused it. And I remember I took out my camera and I was like taking a picture of the screen itself to be like, there's the proof, mm-hmm. right? And then later on in 1972, the Brown Berets would take over Catalina Island outside of Los Angeles and mimicking at least the Alcatraz takeover beforehand. So there was this really interesting idea here of like, well, what we know about the 60s is not what we really know, right? And how does that change then that larger vision of political organizing or how we see these movements or these organizations. And I think that was really critical. And it also helped us to kind of, or helped me kind of pinpoint or begin to define what is red power. And I think a lot of scholars have avoided, you know, trying to define it. And it's not as to say that that definition creates a stagnation, but it's something that gets us to kind of figure out, well, how is red power different from black power? How is it different from brown power? What does it really mean? And how are these organizations owning their own philosophies and ideologies? And how is it, you know, really community centered? And I think for me, that issue came down to not only looking at red power, but then saying, because you meet people and they'll say, well, you know, man, we've had red power since 1492. And I'm like, well, yeah, you're right. But there's something different here, right? And what's different for me was that what came before was more Native nationalism. Mm. And so being able to set up this shift and look at it as a historical process of shifting from organizing and Native nationalism, which we've been doing for centuries, but really, you know, coming out of the Indian Wars in particular, and that was really tribally centered activism in the sense of the Black Hills Council for the Lakota and other organizations. And then it really 1960s is where we get the advent of red power and the encapsulation of that is the ultimate symbol, which is Alcatraz itself.
Today we're speaking with Kent Blansett, Associate Professor of History and Native American Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. His new book is called A Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz, and the Red Power Movement. November 20th marked the 50th anniversary of the indigenous occupation of Alcatraz, a very powerful moment for indigenous people. Before we dive in and talk about Richard Oakes and his childhood and how he made it out to San Francisco, since you're talking about the rich history of indigenous movements and people and how they affected this area, I you have all these great photos in your book, and you talk about the fact that you call San Francisco Indian City. There's an Indian center, Indian bars where a lot of indigenous people gathered to come up with various ideas, talking about Native studies and actions. Is it right? Okay, how many Indian-owned businesses in the Bay Area at that time?
450.
Okay, I thought I got that wrong. 450?
Yeah. 450.
That's amazing. Yeah. Native American studies, powwow culture, Indian churches, Native media.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that people do not know there were 450 owned Indian businesses here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's what I try to showcase is that when Richard moved from New York to San Francisco, he wound up in a very established Native community that had been growing well before even the 1960s. And that's what I was trying to do is challenge previous scholarship that kind of, you know, Alcatraz just came out of the fog of the Bay, right? And there's this longer entrenched, you know, story here in that Native peoples have been living in San Francisco for generations. It's also on Native land. It's Ohlone territory. So, you know, out of this is to recalibrate how San Franciscans may view their own city. And more particularly, that Mission District was absolutely vital. That was the epicenter for the Indian city. So it's not like Richard Oakes, and I have to explain this to my students, wound up in Haight-Ashbury in 1967, 68, you know, during the Summer of Love with Peace Flowers and Patchouli. It was a different city. And that's the stereotype, though, that most people have. And, you know, for Richard, he was embroiled in a very entrenched an established Native city in the Mission District. And it was those institutions that would inspire the movement of Alcatraz. And that time period in 1970, half of our populations resided in American cities. So 50% of the American Indian population, and some of that was coming out of destructive policies like termination, relocation, which I'm happy to talk about, and also World War II. A lot of people came here even during the war to work in the wartime industries, and they never left. They loved it. But there was a lot of people that also came during relocation. One out of seven Native peoples were a part of that program sponsored by the BIA. And San Francisco is one of those six cities that people were removed to. And oftentimes the government would promise, you know, we'll find you a job, you'll have dual income, you know, your kids will have good public schools, and, you know, we'll get you established in a nice place, and, you know, we'll get you going on a little bit of an allowance, you know, to help with groceries until you get your feet, you know, wet or established in the city. And what they usually found is once they got out of the bus depot, those promises were completely broken. Mm-hmm. And this was related by, you know, Lenita Means at the time, who's now Lenita Warjack, right, and many others who came to San Francisco on relocation. I got a chance to interview Mary Lee Johns, who was here in 67 on relocation, and knew Richard and was a student with him at San Francisco State. And it was echoed by everyone who was on that program. And out of this, though, where those institutions failed for the government is where the community came together, and they created an Indian center. Mm-hmm. And the Indian center is what basically became the epicenter for helping those that are on relocation, especially when the mission or parts or aspects of the mission was oftentimes nicknamed the Red Ghetto, which was speaking to this issue of being kind of downtrodden from that relocation program and not having any resources. The Indian center was there to service those resources. Mm-hmm. And it was a community that picked back up on it and preserved at least that Indian city in many ways, shapes, and forms. So out of this, Richard was working in Warren's Slaughterhouse Bar, which was two storefronts down. The Indian Center was on 16th Street. And of course, the original one would burn down later in October of 69. But the story came together, too, through that coalition politic. What was happening in 68 was is the San Francisco State was embroiled in the largest college strikes and riots in American history, in which the students walked out and the faculty walked out. And the sole purpose being, in the end, there's a bigger story to this, but the sole purpose to break it really down, students at San Francisco State realized that there was no content that resembled at least what they experienced on the streets in their own reality. There was no courses in Black studies. There was no courses in Latinx or Chicanx studies. There was no courses in Asian American studies or Native studies. And so what they really wanted was the ethnic studies program. They wanted their courses to represent their neighborhoods. They wanted their courses to represent what their streets look like and what their neighbors look like. And they wanted to know each other better. And that's another kind of element of coalition. Well, they were successful. They got ethnic studies together. And the interesting thing was is that students that were a part of that movement at San Francisco State were operating as tutors at the Indian Center. And they began tutoring Richard and Annie's kids. And that's where they began to learn about this interesting figure who was from Akwesasne Mohawk, who was a former iron worker, that they eventually said, you know, let's make him coordinator of Native American Studies in that first ever class in 1969.
And he was just 27 at the time?
27.
Yep. We're going to take a quick break. Today we're speaking with Kent Blansett, Associate Professor of History and Native American Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. His new book is called A Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz, and the Red Power Movement. Kent first learned about Richard Oakes and the occupation of Alcatraz when he was an undergrad at the University of Missouri, and he wanted to know more about Richard Oakes' life before and after Alcatraz, but he couldn't find much information, so he decided to write a book. His effort took 18 years, and now the book is out, published by Yale University Press. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are joined by Kent Blansett, Associate Professor of History and Native American Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Kent is Cherokee, Creek, Choctaw, Shawnee, and Potawatomi. His new book is called A Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz, and the Red Power Movement. So before the break, we were talking about just the rich history of Indigenous people in San Francisco. And we also talked about what happened at San Francisco State when students demanded an ethnic studies department. And Richard Oakes was brought in to lead, to be the coordinator of the first Native American Studies Department when he was 27. Let's talk a little bit about his younger life. You have a lot of really interesting information in here, and I just, for the first time, really learned about Akwesasne. This is described as being 3,000 square miles with 3,000 people. It crisscrossed the geopolitical border with Canada, went through two different provinces on the Canadian side. Tell us a little bit about this area.
Yeah. So, yeah, six miles square and then 3,000 people, 3,000 problems is how Richard described his home community. And, yeah, you kind of have to understand that it's a Akwesasne, the border crisscrosses through the reservation. So it's a the geopolitical border between Canada and the United States literally bifurcates the reservation. So half is in Canada, the other half is in Akwesasne. And through treaty rights, they have free passage through the Jay Treaty and the Ghent Treaties between the border of Canada and the United States. And many of Richard's people come from the Canadian side as well. And on the Canadian side, they're then split between two provinces that they have to deal with, Ontario and Quebec. And out of that, there's a different kind of political system because Native peoples on the other side of the border in Canada are structured under the Indian Act of 1876, which gives power to the provinces, versus on the other side, on the U.S. side, it's structured by 1934, at least under this idea of federal recognition through the Indian Reorganization Act, so the IRA, which is passed. But then out of this, there's several different political structures. There's the traditional longhouse, which is a part of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, which is part of the organizing six different nations together in this confederacy, of which the Mohawk is one of those nations. And then beyond that traditional structure is then the band councils that you have to deal with on the provincial side, on the Canadian side, and then a state side council as well. So there's like five different political governments alone competing, for control and vibrancy within the community. But for Richard, this was, as I say, he came from a very politically aware community. And that awareness became really clear when I started tracing his trajectory of his family. And his family would eventually get involved in one of the leading occupations at Akwesasne, which was ironwork. And so then I really wanted to write about what is this history? How does ironworking start for Mohawks? And eventually in New York City, they would be about 15% of the ironworking labor force was all Mohawk. And Richard was a part of that. His father was a part of that. His uncles were a part of that. But it wasn't just the men that were a part of it. It was the women as well. And so there was this really interesting situation in which Akwesasne is very matrilineal. It's women-centered society. So even though the men would be working at least 80 stories up and working in these riveting gangs, when they came home, the paychecks went to oftentimes their wives. And the wives managed the property, they managed the expenses, they managed the income. And in other words, they wore the pants in the family in the sense of where that money was spent, because women owned the home, they owned the property in women-centered and matrilineal communities. So that followed through when the community was moving into Brooklyn and taking over and indigenizing Brooklyn and making it a Mohawk city, which for me, just seeing Richard at a young age being a part of that city was really important to be able to try to write that story down. Because it's, when we think of Brooklyn, we don't think of an Indian city.
No, you think of gentrification nowadays. Oh, yeah. And how it's changing so fast. Why did they move to Brooklyn?
So, yeah, it started out in ironworking really goes back to their sister community of Ganawage, which is across the border from Montreal. And they were building a bridge, which was a timber frame construction bridge. And they wanted to build this bridge going, because Ganawage is on the other side of the St. Lawrence Seaway or river from Montreal. And Montreal needed to build a bridge to be able to get products and to ship goods into the United States rather than taking the dangerous Lachine Rapids through the St. Lawrence all the time. So they went to the Ganawage. They said, can we build a bridge on your land? And Ganawage elders said, well, we'll allow you to do this as long as you hire all Ganawage Mohawk to do it. Well, then timber frame construction shifted into ironwork. There was a Quebec bridge disaster that happened in the early part of the 20th century, which then forced a lot of the Klamathas to say, we don't want all of our men working on one job site together in case there's a disaster. It was absolutely horrific what had happened, because they were building the largest cantilever bridge in the world when it collapsed, and many of the men would later even drown because they couldn't rescue them out of the entanglement of the steel structure. So at that point, they started recruiting also from their sister community in Akwesasne. And there was a building boom at the beginning of the 20th century in New York City, where we were getting Rockefeller Center, Chrysler Building, Empire State Building. And all of a sudden, with iron, we could build buildings bigger and taller. And there was a lot of money that was coming in as well to be able to finance these operations. So they literally built that famed skyline. They would first settle in Queens, but then they realized there was a local iron workers union that was in Brooklyn, and the real estate was cheaper around the Red Hook, Gowanus district. And that's where they would settle because they could get to at least their job sites even quicker in Manhattan. And a lot of women also ran boarding homes or boarding houses for the iron workers that were kind of newly coming in or the rookie recruits. So that was another way that women were owning their own business, is they would run these boarding houses for iron workers within the city. And they created this very vibrant city that eventually kind of took over, in which when you walk those streets, you would sometimes hear the Mohawk language being spoken just on the streets. And on the work sites, they would be speaking Mohawk, and other workers would ask them, well, where are you from? And they gained a reputation. There was people that would look to them as being the elders of the industry of ironwork, in the sense of when you get that piece of metal that would flake off into one's eye, or hot metal, the way to get it out was you would use the end of a matchstick, and the sulfur on the end of the matchstick, you'd swipe it around the eye and be able to get the metal off. Well, they learned that from Mohawk ironworkers who had been on the job, you know, for decades even before, that passed these traditions on down. But it was dangerous work. And I think for Richard, it was something that enthralled him because he didn't grow up with his father. At a young age, his father was in World War II. He was part of the D-Day invasion. There was a lot of Mohawk code talkers. He happened to be on the boat. So the idea here was, and a lot of that had to be secretive. It's only been recently that we've been talking about Mohawk code talkers, especially out at Akwesasne. But mostly it's relegated to the soldiers that were on the front. But there had to be somebody on the boats that were the messages were being relayed back to. And it is my guesstimation that that would have been his father, because he was at least on a destroyer or carrier for the D-Day invasion. And then his cousins were serving behind the lines, too. So it was interesting to me to kind of find that out. But when he got back from the war, his parents divorced. So Irene Foote was his mom and Arthur Oakes was his father. And out of that divorce, it really affected the kids in a hard way. Irene all of a sudden was a single mom. She had to find and work double shifts and find two jobs in Brooklyn. She had to put the kids in an orphanage because she didn't have the money to be able to take care of them. So they were living in an orphanage until about the age of three, he and his brother Leonard. And they were very tight. They were only a couple years apart. So they're very close out of that. And their mother raised them. And so they were raised by a strong Mohawk woman. But he didn't know much about his dad because he was constantly in ironwork. When he came back from the war, he was moving from place to place for this ironwork. And I think that's why at the age of 16, he would drop out of school and he would join his father at an early age because his dad was a foreman. So he could get him on, even though he was 16, he could get him on the job site earlier. And that's when he never looked back. He kept on with ironwork up and down throughout the East Coast.
And I just want to repeat something. So you say that the iron that they used was used to build the Empire State Building, Rockefeller Center, and other well-known skyscrapers in New York City.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so interesting because so many people either have ties to New York or they visited Manhattan, and you know, you go see these amazing buildings. And every time I go to a city, I try to look, are there any sort of exhibits or any information about indigenous history? And usually the answer is no. At least in Manhattan, right at the edge of Wall Street, there is a nice native museum. but that there should be some little wayside exhibit or some form of information that tells people about the history of these buildings.
I join you in that excitement. I'm waiting for New York to follow through and Brooklyn to follow through and create a kind of a new indigenous interpretation of ironwork in the city. I mean, that's a big part of it. At NMAI, several years back, which is the National Museum of American Indian, there's a New York branch that's located in Battery Park, and they hosted the first ever exhibit on ironworkers, Mohawk ironworkers, but Haudenosaunee ironworkers, because it wasn't just Mohawks, it was also Senecas, Cayugas, there was Tuscaroras. So all the nations a part of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy would eventually join up that ironworking force. And what was interesting to me was, why did they do it? And National Geographic in 1952 did a feature article called Mohawk Scrape the Sky. And it was kind of interesting because they were giving us and assigning us these really interesting superhero abilities, like, as Indians, you know, we must be unafraid of walking, you know, 80 floors up and have perfect balance and, you know, with our footsteps, because, yeah, we're Indian, right? And it just was kind of, I guess, flattering maybe for the Mohawk ironworkers at the time, but every one of them that I interviewed said, no, we were deathly afraid. You know, you had to treat it very seriously. And out of that, there was a lot of Mohawks that would die. But it was an industry that they could become a part of and a commanding force in, because there was no discrimination. Because literally, it was, as I say, you want to work 80 stories up without a safety harness and face the potential of dying in building these buildings? Come one, come all. And because of that, they could take a commanding force in that industry. But it was dangerous work. In fact, Richard, when I interviewed Dean Chavers, first time Dean had kind of seen Richard without his shirt off, he went to pick him up, and they were going to drive for occupations up at Pitt River. And he saw Richard changing in the back room, and he had all these scars on his chest. And he was like, oh my gosh, who did that to you? Like, what happened? And we're just like, oh yeah, I was an iron worker. And so I was a catcher on the line. And when they would heat up those hot rivets, they would throw them down, and you had this little cone-shaped metal container that you had to catch them in, this cone-shaped bucket. Well, oftentimes in the summer, it would be hot, so you take your shirt off while you're working. But those hot rivets would sometimes zing and ding off of the can, and it would sear his skin. But for him, he wore it like as a badge of honor. It was like, this is who I am, and I carry it with me. But there was also something there, too, that I noticed that kind of did take fear away when he would speak to reporters. It's like, here's a guy that survived 80 stories up without harnesses, and now people are asking about indigenous rights, and he kind of had no fear in the sense of being that voice or speaking to reporters at that time. And he had a sense of clarity and purpose within those interactions. And I think ironwork also, in that coming apart of that community of Haudenosaunee ironworkers, but more importantly, that longhouse, really kind of affected his leadership at an early age and kind of made him step up onto the scene, more particularly by the time he came to San Francisco.
This is Your Call, and today we're speaking with Kent Blancett, Associate Professor of History and Native American Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Kent's new book is called A Journey to Freedom: Richard Oakes, Alcatraz, and the Red Power Movement. So, since you talked about Richard's time in New York and how that kind of made him fearless and affected so much of who he became, it also really helped him become a great organizer, which is directly connected to the occupation of Alcatraz.
Exactly, yeah. No, this idea that you're having to work in a team. So usually these ironworker gangs, you'd have one guy that was heating up the rivets in a hot coal bucket. You'd have another guy that was kind of the thrower, or the pitcher, if you will, who would then take those hot rivets out and throw them down the line. And then there was a catcher, which is what Richard's position was. And the catcher would then take the hot rivets out, place them one by one into those beams, into the pre-drilled holes. And then there'd be another guy on the other end with a pneumatic hammer, and they would pound down that other end and taper it in. And then when that hot river would cool, literally all the oxygen was taken out, and it'd be a perfect seal. But every one of those buildings was built rivet by rivet, you know, beam by beam, like a giant erector set. And there was this kind of dance, this coordination between the derrick operators, throwing down hand signals of when the beams should come up, when you should be able to assemble them. And it was this really wonderful orchestra of organ of coming together to create this larger than life, you know, building that would eventually be kind of the most recognizable structures of the city of New York. And Richard was a part of that. And I think, yeah, when he went to the island, he took those skills with him. And those skills were also about, well, how do we then make over Alcatraz? How do we repair the docks? How do we, you know, start building something here? And he was coming from that building and construction background. And I think that's really what also transformed and helped to change that vision of the island.
Let's talk about some of the questions that these young people at the time were really exploring. You write about them taking night classes on Native liberation at the Far Out Laboratory, which is directed by Dr. Jack Forbes. He was one of the few Native people at the time who got his PhD. And the questions were things like, how do we get our land back? How do we protect our treaty rights?
Yeah, yeah. And for Richard, you know, he was kind of involved in indigenous studies, but kind of an outside classroom kind of way. I mean, I think most Native students coming in at that point had also done the same, which was, who are we? What are we about, right? What is our history?
And to give this context, yeah. Sorry to interrupt you, but what we had Dr. Lenita Warjack on, she said something interesting. She said, on the res, you've got major poverty. Mm. And if you escape it, you're going to face major discrimination. Yeah. No Indians or dogs allowed. And she said when she came to San Francisco, back home, if you met another Native person, you'd say, well, what tribe are you? She said, in San Francisco, it was just like, yes, I found another Native. Oh, let's build a community. This is amazing. Yeah. But at the same time, they missed home.
Yeah.
And so it was like they got relocated again.
Mm.
So I think that it was just, that's a really powerful thing to think about.
Well, and they discovered something else that's very much a part of the urban Indian experience, which is intertribalism.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that, you know, we're categorizing this ethnic Americanization experiment as being Native American or American Indian, but that displaces the idea that we're essentially coming from Native nations. We're tribal peoples. You know, we're Cherokee, we're Creek, we're Choctaw, we're, you know, Lakota, we're Dene. And out of that, it's as to say, what does it mean when we come together as a greater community for our rights as indigenous peoples? And so then it was those questions come alive, like, well, man, what was termination like on your reservation, or how'd you guys escape it, or what's relocation like for you? In fact, you know, Warren's Slaughterhouse Bar, where Richard Oakes was a bartender, which, you know, Dean Chavers described as the grungiest bar in the world, that was like a bar that you would not want to step foot in. Richard was a bartender of, but that was a place too where Russell Means, a later leader in the American Indian movement, said it was the first place he had heard about termination. In other words, we weren't just kind of in the bars for drinking. It was this place of socialization, but politicization as well. And that coming together in these intertribal kind of hamlets like San Francisco and other spaces, it politicized us, but it also encouraged a greater movement in the sense of understanding that larger story of our history and our shared histories, that embedded within that is a coalition politic automatically within intertribalism. But through this, it's as I say, the students were learning and taking classes and trying to create classes that they never had before in their K-12 education, which, sad to say, is still an epidemic issue throughout America. I still work with teachers throughout Nebraska on this issue that we have usually called the trifecta of some sort, where you start off and kids maybe learn about Columbus sailing the ocean blue, which is still, you know, this idea that he's heroic, even though he starts the transatlantic slave trade in America. And then you then jump usually to Pocahontas in Jamestown. And then from there, maybe you'll see Sacagawea with Lewis Clark. And then from there, you may just maybe talk about the Battle of Wounded Knee, as they still sometimes call it in textbooks, instead of the Massacre of Wounded Knee. And then we fade from history. We fade from the books. We have no 20th century experience, no modernity, which is why I wanted to be a 20th century scholar, at least as another Native scholar looking at the 20th century experience. And out of this, I think that's what the students in that period of time we're also gravitating to, is like what I kind of went through as a young student at Mizzou, like, how do I find all these books? How do I find that history? And beyond, what do we use it for, right? And liberation became kind of that larger ideal. And they were meeting with not just Jack Forbes, but Forbes would have guest speakers come in from the National Indian Youth Council, like Clyde Warrior and Mel Thom. And they would also be talking about the Fishens movement, which was happening in Washington State, which had been going on since the 1940s, but really heated up in the 1960s and 64. And out of this, people were getting arrested for trying to do what their treaty rights gave them the permission to be able to do, which was to harvest salmon out of season. And out of this, multiple arrests were happening, but they began learning of these stories, or they had the White Roots of Peace caravan come to San Francisco State from Richard's home community. And they began to learn about the occupations that were happening on Cornwall Island, where many of his relatives lived, in which they shut down the bridge because they started at least, you know, preventing people from using the treaties from free passage across the border. They started basically taxing people, and that violated the treaty. And so they literally shut the bridge down. They had a sit-in on the bridge, and they shot a video of it called "You're on Indian Land," which became one of the political statements that would later be painted on Alcatraz Island. And so out of this, it was, as I say, there was multiple different influences for Alcatraz, but it starts in the classroom. It was an academic discourse. And I thought, you know, as a teacher, for me, that's really important, because when I talk to my students, they begin to realize, oh my gosh, students were really active in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Students were making change. Students can make change. And it is possible. It's not a myth. And it did happen. And out of this, too, it was recalibrating that kind of vision of where was Alcatraz going to go, and how do we understand it? What is the greater meanings of it? But it is a student movement, primarily.
And I didn't know until I read your book that they went to Alcatraz first. There was a first boat ride over there, and then they decided to leave the island, reconnect, and then do it for a longer time. And at that point, over the next couple of days, Richard traveled to California universities to kind of build a larger occupation and let students know what they were planning to do.
Yeah, no, he went to university after university, San Jose State. Then he drove all the way down to UCLA. This is where he met Ed Castillo. And Ed Castillo was a professor there, and he would actually bring students up from LA. That was a very large contingent of that D-Day occupation in November 20th of 1969. And Ed has this really great story about they checked out cars from UCLA to be able to drive up to San Francisco, but then they abandoned the cars and on the streets of San Francisco, and they don't know whatever happened to those cars again. But it was one of those things where when Ed heard Richard speak, he said electric. He was ignited into wanting to be a part of this larger movement. And he had a way of, when he spoke, to not only excite audiences, but to inspire you to see something bigger than yourself, to see something bigger in your actions and what those actions can produce. And it really enthralled people and encapsulated them to want to be a part of this larger movement.
I just looked at the time, and we only have about 4 minutes left.
Oh, wow.
It just went by so fast. So let's go over a couple things really quickly. The media coverage they got was really incredible. You write about John Trudell interviewing people on the island about their stories. This was Radio Free Alcatraz, which ran on KPFA, right in our backyard. They published the Indians of All Tribes newsletter. They indigenized the island with graffiti. You are on Indian land, which you can still see on the island today. And I like this one. Custer had it coming. Yes. Just quickly, Kent, this is a pre-tape show. You're in town for the 50th anniversary, but we got bumped because of the impeachment hearings. You just went to the island to mark this amazing anniversary. Can you just tell us what happened there when they painted the letters?
Yeah,
just quickly.
Yeah, and so one of the main things that we did yesterday was the recovery of the sign. So when you come in onto the docks, the first sign that you see is an Indian's welcome sign. Which for me was liberating the first time I went there, because I'd seen photos of it, but I'd never, like, I didn't associate with this is the first thing you see. And I didn't get it until I was on the boat and I saw it. And I write about this kind of at the end of the book. And it's kind of re-envisioning how we see the movement or the takeover as a success. But that literally decolonized my mind at the time, because I realized it was the only welcome sign I'd ever seen in my own homelands. And it made me realize, why is that? And why is it that we have to go to a prison to feel free? And so literally what they did is they educated a young me in those political statements is what they begin to call them instead of graffiti, because they say, well, graffiti's art, right? This is something bigger than art. This is a political statement for a community. And so what they did yesterday is they got to repaint the Indians welcome sign in Indian land that's below it. And what's interesting was is it's the first time in 50 years that this has come together, because when the federal marshals came on board, they took that sign and they burned it, and then they put their own graffiti over it. So then what the National Park Service would do 1 year later in 1972 when they would take over the island is they replaced the sign, but they covered up the edits that were made of the sign, which instead of United States property, they called it United Indian property and scratched out the states. So they liberated that sign. Well, yesterday they got to liberate it again, and a new generation will get to see it in a new way. But for me, it was exhilarating. I was in a fandom kind of moment as well. And for me, it was just the chance to be able to applaud those veterans. For me, that's that's what it's all about. They deserve that applause. They deserve to be seen as veterans of this movement because they made changes that, for me, I wouldn't be where I am today without those changes, in the sense of 26 pieces of self-determination legislation, ending termination and relocation, which Nixon in 1970 would come out and end those programs and start a new era of self-determination legislation, 29 Supreme Court cases. So, yeah, they affected my life. They changed my life. And for that, yeah, pretty cool.
Very cool. Kent Blansett is author of a new excellent book. There's so much in here that we did not have time for. I hope you can get your hands on this book. It's called A Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz, and the Red Power Movement. And there's a link at yourcallradio.org. Kent is Associate Professor of History and Native American Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He is Cherokee, Creek, Choctaw, Shawnee, and Potawatomi. Kent, thank you so much. Great to meet you, and I learned so much from this book. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Rose, for having me. It's great to be here.
Check out our show for more information about Kent's work and the 50th anniversary of the occupation of Alcatraz. It was on November 20th, yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Sho McPolin for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.